We're in the book of Acts. Paul is in his missionary journeys. He has come to Ephesus. It's been a great time. God has given him a good period of time there. He's able to establish a Bible school. And as a result of that, many people were saved. Many people were activated to the ministry and went out. Several churches were being started, and several of his letters to churches were written from Ephesus at the time. What we found is that there was a the success of Christianity had some consequences. That's always true. And in this case, it was Demetrius the silversmith who had enough of it. He found he was coming out of his shop and saying, little shrines for Diana, our great goddess, and people are saying, no, I gave that up when I became a Christian. So he gathered all the silversmiths together, and they are rioting. They've grabbed people and brought them in and taken them to the place of the political arena, the theater, amphitheater. And this was the official place where Ephesus had the right to gather and make political decisions. But the word theater here is the word ecclesia. It's the word that we use for church. So at the essence, the word means assembly. And so what we're seeing here in the word assembly or theater is the original meaning of the church in the sense that they chose the word, this word, ecclesia, for the church because it was an assembly. It was the gathering together. People have mistakenly taken the etymology of the word ek, meaning out, and kaleo, to call, that we are to be the people called out from the world and that type of thing. Well, it's not a spiritual word. It's a secular word, and it means called out of their homes to assemble. It's that meaning. So as we did today, we left our homes to assemble here. Also, they were able to make voting decisions that affected them and so on. So that is how the church began. All right, I'm calling this the stupidity of Paul's foes. And we see this by, first of all, their mob-like character. So some there, verse 32, some therefore cried one thing, some another, for the assembly was confused, and the more part knew not wherefore they were come together. So, what are we here for? Nobody knew. And assembly is Strong 1577, ecclesia. The usage shows the original meaning of the word, which later became known as the church. So if you think of the church as the assembly, you capitalize A, and we are the assembly for God, for Christ. The word is used throughout this passage in verse 39 and 41. Confused is the word, sogeo, meaning literally to pour together, commingle. They're all jammed in together, but nobody knows exactly why. We called a meeting. Coming to mean to disturb the mind of one, to stir up, to tumult or outbreak, to confound or bewilder. So you have a bunch of stupid people gathered together. Don't know what they're there for. Now we see the mechanical chant. Alexander's defense is offered. They drew Alexander out of the multitude, the Jews putting him forward, and Alexander beckoned with the hand would have made his defense unto the people. Now, we're not quite sure who this Alexander was. Homer Kent says, the Jews put him forward, so it's uncertain whether this was Alexander, a Christian Jew, or not. It's more likely that he was not, since the Jews put him forward to give a defense. The Jews wanted the Ephesian Gentiles to know they were not to blame for Paul's actions. Paul was, you know, evidently clearly racially characteristic of a Jew, and it was his work that was causing this and so on. So they were trying to do this. However, Alexander is drowned out. But when they knew that he was a Jew, all with one voice about the space of 2 hours, cried out, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." Well, this sounds like a real intellectual group. Can you just imagine being in this group for 2 hours and all you're saying is, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians," and this to shout down any defense for anything else? When you don't have an argument, shout louder. Shout the opponent down. Well, it turns out that the Jews' plan backfired because the Gentiles recognized him as the one who opposed the worship of Diana. The Jews themselves opposed that worship. So try to imagine chanting these 4 words for 2 hours. So I give you the words in the Greek. Megala a Artemis, which is Diana, Ephesian of the Ephesians. 4 words for 2 hours. I wonder if they had a cheerleader up there. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Anyway, not a meeting I want to be to. Then we see that the town clerk praises Diana. This is the diffusing of the crowd, and he does this, I find, very very interestingly. Did I miss it? Oh yeah, there we go. The collapse of the riot with a word of wisdom, and the town clerk praises Diana. No question of Diana's position. So, the town clerk, now that sounds like a menial job. Sounds like the guy in town who has to write down bureaucratic stuff. But he was the head of it. And we'll get into that. When the town clerk had appeased the people, he said, "Ye men of Ephesus." Appease means got him to stop chanting. "Ye men of Ephesus, what man is there that knoweth not how that the city of Ephesus is a worshiper of the great goddess Diana, and of the image which fell down from Jupiter?" He's not talking about the planet. He's talking about the god Jupiter or Zeus. A.T. Robertson, the careful Greek scholar, said, "Town clerk, this officer is not a mere secretary of another officer, or like the copyists and students of the law among the Jews, but the most influential person in Ephesus, who drafted decrees with the aid of the strategoi," plural of the word, "and had charge of the city's money, was the power in control of the assembly, and communicated directly with the proconsul," who was the main political head over the city. And the inscriptions of Ephesus give frequently this very title for their chief officer, and the papyri have it also. The papyri are early word for paper. Papyri came from the papyri is plural for papyrus. And there was a reed plant that grew by the waters that they would flatten it out, dry it out, and the strands were made, and then they interwove that and pressed it down and made paper. So we don't have many of those left. But where things were stored and kept dry and that type of thing. This is the classical stuff ended up being written on clay and engraved in stone and that type of thing. So that would last nearly forever. But we find that the papyri could be easily damaged, so they become very precious. He calls them the worshiper. It's the word neokoros, meaning originally one who sweeps and cleans the temple. So one who is dedicated to keeping that up, but it came to mean a worshiper of a deity, the person dedicated to that deity. All right, so he says, hey, everybody knows this. Everybody knows that this city worships Diana. Then no quarreling of deafening protest. Seeing then that these things cannot be spoken against, ye ought to be quiet and to do nothing rashly. Because he saw this was a mob mentality getting ready to take people and tear them apart. And then I find the wisdom here is admirable, because how do you fight a mob? Well, you pinpoint the guy that started it, and you let him know that you know that if the trouble comes up, he's going to be called on the carpet for blame. See? So the men, he pinpoints Demetrius, the men are not criminals. For ye have brought hither these men, which are neither robbers of churches, nor yet blasphemers of your goddess. See, it's one thing to say, worship this other deity. It's another thing to say, that deity is horrible. That deity is bad. Robbers of churches actually is literally robbers of temples. They weren't thinking of churches at all. The Greek word found in all the manuscripts and all the editions of the TR describes someone who robs temples, not churches. The A.T. Robertson defines it as a common word in Greek writers from hieron for temple and solao to rob, to be guilty of sacrilege. So I have no idea why they decided to translate it that, except people were not familiar with robbing temples, but maybe they were familiar with robbing churches. So he says the men are not criminals. First of all, they haven't stolen anything out of your temple, and neither are they blaspheming your goddess. So you couldn't arrest them, you couldn't prove anything against them in law. Then the malice is not correct. Wherefore, if Demetrius, he calls him out, and the craftsmen which are with him, you see, he knew who was guilty, have a matter against any man. The law is open, and there are deputies. Let them implead one another. So the town clerk wisely identifies Demetrius, let him know that he's not hiding behind this mob. He could be held responsible for inciting the riot. He's here for an economic reason. He doesn't want to get fined. Law is the word agorias. It means agora from marketplace. He says the law is open. The arena is open here. And here the word means the sessions of court. A.T. Robertson calls it an old adjective from agora, forum, the marketplace where trials were held. Implead, I wasn't familiar with this, it means to call in one's case to bring a charge against. So he says this is all open. The law is still working, and we see the word translated otherwise in these other verses. All right, then the method is not constitutional. So he says, but if you inquire anything concerning other matters, it shall be determined in a lawful assembly. The implication here is you guys are out of order. Lawful is Strong's enomos, meaning literally in law. Nomos is law, in law. And it means here lawful or regular. So he refers to they had a regular scheduled assembly where they would meet and talk about these things. He says, this is considering an uprising when the people gather for a political meeting when it's not been called. So they're not following, they're not within the law. So he gives them a word of warning, meeting without cause. For we are in danger to be called in question for today's uproar, there being no cause whereby we may give an account of this concourse. So the authorities would say, why did you meet? Who called this official assembly? And all of this is weighing right on Demetrius's head, see? And then the craftsmen. So, meeting wisely canceled. And when he had thus spoken, he dismissed the assembly. And Demetrius, with his head down, hat pulled low, was one of the first ones out. You have to read that in the footnotes. All right. With this, however, Paul sees that the quiet growth of Christianity is going to be best. Rather than having great spokesmen for Christianity there, calling attention to it, dramatic things happening, the healings and the casting out of demons, all of these things. He's thinking, who's next? The occultists are going to rally to a mob and say, down with the people who we've lost all our sales for the Ephesian letters, the amulets of protection, and so on. Nobody believes in this anymore. So he decides to leave. So we come then to number three, the tour through Macedonia, Achaia, and Troas. So first of all, Macedonia. Now, embracing exit from Exodus, after the uproar ceased, Paul called unto him the disciples and embraced them and departed for to go into Macedonia. He says, time to lessen the impact here and take the message elsewhere. Now, this is in Greece, Macedonia next door to it. Then we see the exhorting excursion through Macedonia. When he had gone over those parts in Macedonia and had given them much exhortation, he came into Greece. Given them much exhortation is literally exhorting them with many words. So it wasn't haphazard. He wasn't calling out from the chariot as he drove by. He stopped, talked to the churches, counseled the people. Exhortation is that word parakaleo, and it could mean encouragement and comfort. All of this he was giving as well as exhorting them. Then he moved on to Achaia. You see, it was a three-month stay there in Greece. He abode there 3 months. During this time, he wrote the epistle to the Romans. We love the book of Romans. It's a great book of doctrine. And it was the fact that Paul wasn't able to get there that prompted him to write the letter. We need to recognize that sometimes what God lets us do is important and what God keeps us from doing is important, because there are consequences of both, and God is sometimes urging those consequences, like writing to Romans instead of visiting there. Then the murderous scheme, when the Jews laid wait for him as he was about to sail into Syria. So they laid wait, they want this man gone. The Macedonian strategy, he purposed to return through Macedonia. So I don't know what they were going to do, ram the boat, board it, pretending to be Captain Hook and the pirates. And I don't know what they were going to do. But so it looked like he was going to sail, but he turned around and went back through Macedonia. Then the messenger society, and there accompanied him into Asia Sopater of Berea, and of the Thessalonians Aristarchus and Secundus. We met them back in Ephesus, and Gaius of Derbe and Timotheus. Evidently, Timothy was from the city of Derbe, and of Asia Tychicus and Trophimus. Looking at these places, Eastern Bible Dictionary tells us a little about these people. Sopater, probably the same as Sosipater, a kinsman of Paul, Romans 16:21. Timotheus, my work fellow, Lucius, Jason, Sopater, my kinsman. Some relationship. Salute you. Christian of the city of Berea, who accompanied Paul into Asia. Aristarchus, native of Thessalonica, a companion of Paul. He was Paul's fellow prisoner at Rome. Secundus means second. You have a second child and you don't know what to name him. Let's call him second. Gaius, a man of Derbe, who accompanied Paul into Asia on his last journey to Jerusalem. And Timothy, we know. Tychicus, an Asiatic Christian, faithful minister to the Lord, according to Ephesians 6:21-22, who, when Trophimus accompanied Paul on the part of the journey from Macedonia to Jerusalem. He's alluded to also in Colossians 4:7 and so on, as having been with Paul at Rome, where he was sent for trial. Whence he sent him to Ephesus. While he was waiting for trial, he sent him back to Ephesus, probably for the purpose of building up and encouraging the church there. Then Trophimus, a name that means a foster child, which doesn't necessarily mean he was in the system type of thing. He was adoption was a big thing. Sometimes if you were making a name for yourself as a poet or musician, as a even a warrior, a soldier, a famous family would adopt you because they wanted you in their family. They wanted your name, their name attached to you. So it could be that in that sense. He was an Ephesian who accompanied Paul during a part of his third missionary journey. He was with Paul in Jerusalem, and the Jews, supposing that the apostle had brought him with him into the temple, raised a tumult, which resulted in Paul's imprisonment. In writing to Timothy, Apostle Paul says, Trophimus have I left at Miletum sick. We know that much about him. This refers to an event not recorded in Acts. All right, moving on then, we see the movement schedule. These going before tarried for us at Troas. So while Paul made his visits and preached his messages and encouraged and challenged the people, others went on, and the idea is go ahead and get places ready, let people know that he's coming. So we come then to Troas. The second of the we passages begins here, indicating that coming back through Philippi, Luke rejoined the group. F.F. Bruce puts this at the autumn of A.D. 55. There's a memorable meeting. We see the Lord's Supper. And we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, the Jewish feast of unleavened bread around Passover, and came unto them to Troas in 5 days, where we abode 7 days, and upon the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread. We find here that even in the comment of the Jewish celebration, which the Christian Jews kept these celebrations, Matthew held a Passover for us 1 year as the opportunities came. Nothing wrong with that. We can, with the Christian understanding, get a lot more out of it than most of the non-Christian Jews did at the time. But so they were keeping the Jewish, as much of a family heritage thing as anything else. We keep Christmas when there's nothing about a Christmas celebration in the Bible. And in fact, the early Puritans thought it was a pagan thing to do. Martin Luther and the Germans overcame and said, it's a great tradition. You like bring a tree in, decorate it. It's fun. So we've adopted that. I've told people, criticizing people for bringing in the trees and decorating it, like it talks about doing it with idols, And I said, no, we converted our tree. We use a tree that points upward, like pointing to Jesus, And it's an evergreen, picturing everlasting life. And then at the top, we put a star, like the Star of Bethlehem, or an angel, like the angel that was overseeing it all. And then the presents are underneath, so you have to come and you have to bow down and kneel to get your presents, the free gift that comes. And that's the way salvation is. You don't buy those gifts. You kneel in humility and receive them. So we converted our Christmas tree. So it's an entirely Christian Christmas tree. But they kept up those traditions. Yet, on the first day of the week, day after the Sabbath, they came together for their church, for their assembly. So meeting on Sundays had become traditional. The long sermon. Paul preached unto them, ready to depart on the morrow, and continued his speech until midnight. Well, he had a lot to say. A lot of things had been going on, and perhaps they had heard the rumors and heard all this, and we thought you were dead. We thought you were going to be strung up. And I said, well, it, you know, it's one of those things that could have happened, but God protected us. He had a long sermon. And it was a lighted scene. There were many lights in the upper chamber where the people were gathered together. So we're talking about a three-story something or other here, and balconies on the way up, and many lights. Now, these were not LED lights. Just wanted you to know. Neither were they electric at all. They were candles and whatever else, lanterns. So you have an enclosed space, you have a tall area, and you have many lights. So it's getting pretty warm, especially up at the top. And up there, we meet a guy. The miracle, the midnight miracle, we find. Eutychus is waiting here. Toward midnight, he had a busy day, excited to see Paul, hear what he had to say. But got really warm. So the effect of Paul's sermon. There sat in a window, where you get some air, I guess, a certain young man named Eutychus, being fallen into a deep sleep. And as Paul was long preaching, he sunk down with sleep and fell down from the third loft and was taken up dead. So, you know, it's one thing to fall asleep. It's another thing to fall asleep. So he fell down. He didn't wake up because he was dead. Eutychus was, in fact, dead. Homer Kent points out when Dr. Luke says he was taken up dead, he says it differently than his description of Paul at Lystra, supposing he had been dead. So we have no reason to doubt that he actually died, whether he had a concussion to death, whether he broke his neck, we don't know. But he was taken up dead. So the effect of Paul's sincerity, notice the sincere compassion. Paul went down. He was evidently not on the bottom floor, up someplace where he could talk to them, and fell upon him, embracing him. This is not, I'm guessing, mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. This is not some medical thing. It just seems to be, you know, how awful that this would have happened at my reunion with these people. Then significant caution, and after he's done hugging him, he finds, and perhaps not as surprisingly as it would be for us today, but miracles were happening at the hands of Paul all the time, he finds he eyes flutter open, he begins to take a breath, and heart is beating. So he says, and said, trouble not yourselves, for his life is in him. So we find here the miracle of resurrection was complete but not evident. He was evidently sleeping, but Paul could tell he was back to life. And then sensible counsel. When he therefore was come up again and had broken bread and eaten, the meeting seems to have been held in the third loft, for the church returns up again to celebrate the Lord's Supper as they had intended, and ate a meal as well. So he gets something to eat. Then spiritual conversation, and talked a long while, even till the break of a day, and so he departed. So perhaps not now just preaching, but sitting around, not on any dangerous ledge, and having spiritual conversation. My wife and I, when we were dating, had spiritual conversations. We talked a lot. There was a whole thing about getting to know each other on a far deeper level. And more than once, we continued the conversation past midnight, and we were nervous to bring her home late at night. We started parking out in front because when it got too bad, then they would flick the porch light on and off for us. So I said, okay, it's time. But we always had something else to say. But very much of it was me coming back from Bob Jones and being a Bible student, and my wife very curious about these things and asking questions that had come up to her, and I being thrilled to be able to answer questions that I hadn't known before. So we talked a lot. So I understand this whole thing, especially where you're talking to the guy who's at the vanguard of Christianity, plunging into dark areas of Gentile misunderstanding and heathen religion, strange power of the occult and all that stuff. He says, no, there wasn't anything to it. And tell him the stories, you know. So it was quite an education in a lot of ways. All right. So then he departed and with solid comfort, and they brought the young men alive and were not a little comforted. Not a little. I like the way they say that. There was three cheers for Eutychus. So Eutychus awake, brought forth for all to see. They were comforted. This is parakaleo. They were comforted. They were perhaps even exhorted, but certainly encouraged. So they see the miracle at midnight. We come then to the moving message. We got a lot to get into there, so let's stop there, and we'll look at the moving messengers next time as they move on to the new area and new adventures. All right, comments or questions? Bring up something you wondered about, or should we have a spiritual conversation until Jerry falls asleep? Yes. I don't know. He was hardworking, I'm guessing. He worked hard, but no, we don't really know. It's just a relative term. A lot of people seem young to me now. I remember when I first started noticing that grade school kids were driving. It was just amazing to me to look over there and see those young faces in the cars. And really? Does your mother know you're out? Now I'm getting to the place where I go to the doctor, and the doctor is a grade school kid. You know, it's just strange to see the comparison of young and old, but it's, he was just, it could be a teenager, but I don't know what they consider to be grown young men at that time.
So you know how excited a lot of people get in sports overtime.
Mm-hmm.
So we should all get excited if the sermon goes overtime.
That's right.
That's my note in my Bible. This is sermon overtime.
Sermon overtime.
You should get excited. Just don't fall asleep.
Yeah, that's
most
right.
Most people don't in overtime with sports-related issues. So.
There's some movie where the guy was trying to stay awake all night, and he made himself a thorn necklace that whenever his head dropped down, he stuck him. And we'll have that out for you for the late night services. Get your thorn necklace here. Yes, sir.
I think I might have missed something.
Okay.
You had mentioned in verse 4 the fellows that went ahead to wait at Troas. You had mentioned that someone had put that in the fall or in August in the year. The next verse it says, obviously, after the days of unleavened bread, which is Passover in the spring, and then 5 days later, they joined them at Troas. So I'm a little confused. Did I miss something? How did we go from 5 days after Passover to suddenly being in August?
Yeah, we'll have to take that up to with F.F. Bruce. I don't know. I hadn't caught that. But yeah, Passover and unleavened bread is normally around our Easter time, so. Sam.
One of the things that kind of sticks out to me, and it's because there's a lot of random stuff going on today.
They tend to what?
Be stupid.
Yeah, that's true. A mob is a mob because they, by gathering together under some name, under some cause, at least a perceived cause, they've stopped thinking. So they're doing terrible things. Turning over cars, setting things on fire, hurting people. That it may be that that individual, if you brought him out of his society and stood him by himself, said, "Do you want to hit this guy in the head with a brick?" Well, maybe, but I wouldn't do that, you know. But in a mob, they'll do that. They become stupid because it's a mob. So there's a lesson for today. Don't get into mobs. Write that down. Stitch that on a pillow, right? Don't get in a mob. Bad idea. All right. Anyone else? Good. All right. Well, let's stand together. We'll be dismissed with prayer. Our Father, how we thank you for the Word of God, for the stories that we know are guaranteed to be true. You actually inspired the very words written. We ask that you might help us to picture ourselves back in that time and recognize that that time could be now, that as the world darkens around us, as it seems, our light will shine, and perhaps there will be attacks, perhaps there will be mob actions against the Christians, what they think Christians are doing or preventing from happening. We ask that you might help us to recognize that you're in control of all things, that we have nothing to fear as long as we're following your way. For even death is a liberation for us, so we're not intimidated by whatever people can do. So we ask that you might guide and direct us and help us to learn from these great men of the past. We pray thy blessing in Jesus' name. Amen.